Hey, it's Jen. Just a quick heads up before we start the show. The news is rapidly developing and things may have changed by the time you hear this episode. For the latest news, tune into your public radio station and follow updates at npr.org.
This is the 1A podcast. I'm Nyla Boodoo of Axios Today, in for Jen White, and this is the news roundup. The Freedom to Vote Act is dead, but filibuster reform might not be.
If, in fact, I get myself into, at this moment, the debate on the filibuster, I lose at least three votes to get what I have to get done.
But are you saying, when it comes to voting rights, just so I'm clear, though, you would entertain the notion of doing away with the filibuster on that one issue? Is that correct?
And maybe more.
And maybe other issues.
That was President Biden speaking to Anderson Cooper at a CNN town hall last night. Could filibuster reform be resurrected? And what would that mean for the Democrats' agenda, which is so far struggling to push a bill to the president's desk? We'll get into it, plus some big news on boosters, and Congress cracks down on a Trumpian no-show with ties to the insurrection. Joining us today, Anita Kumar is the senior editor of Standard and Ethics at Politico. Welcome, Anita.
Thanks for having me back.
Naftali Ben-David is a White House editor at The Washington Post. Naftali, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Cheryl Gay Stolberg is a Washington correspondent covering health policy at The New York Times. Cheryl, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This week, the Freedom to Vote Act failed in the Senate against unanimous opposition from Republicans. Here's Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell explaining the pushback.
This latest bill still subjects popular common sense election integrity protections like voter ID to the whims of federal bureaucrats. It still sends government money to political campaigns. Government money, taxpayers' money, to political campaigns. For goodness sake, it still puts Washington in the middle of states' redistricting decisions, and on and on. The same rotten core is all still there.
The bill was aimed at strengthening voting rights, in part by establishing Election Day as a national holiday and setting national standards for early voting and voting by mail. Naftali, what else do we need to know about what else was in this bill?
I mean, I think the main thing to know about this was that it was an exercise to put pressure on the filibuster. I mean, yes, it was about voting rights, but everybody knew how it was going to go down. All Republicans were going to be against. All Democrats were going to be for. And particularly the audience here was Joe Manchin. He had a big hand in crafting this bill. He's been one of the opponents of changing the filibuster. And Democrats wanted to show him, and particularly Chuck Schumer, the majority leader, wanted to show him that even when he crafts a bill, works very hard to get Republican support on these important issues, in a lot of cases, all Republicans are going to be opposed. And I think that's what we saw play out yesterday, not a surprise, but a point.
Which leads us to the idea of filibuster reform. Cheryl, we just heard President Biden from last night alluding to this idea. What would that entail?
So it would be very significant. It would really be the final step on what has been a long path toward eroding the rights of the minority party in the Senate. You know, Jefferson famously said that the Senate was the saucer that cooled what happened in the House. It was the more deliberative body. The filibuster, the provision that requires a 60-vote threshold to move forward on much major legislation, and also in the past on judicial nominees, was kind of a break in a way in the Senate. It forced the parties to come together. Now we've seen that Democrats stripped away the filibuster for judicial nominees other than the Supreme Court. Republicans retaliated by stripping away the filibuster for Supreme Court nominees. What's left is the filibuster on major legislation. The president said last night that he does not want to, as you heard him say, lose the filibuster for the current policy bill that's before the Senate, the social policy bill, because he knows he'll lose votes. But the fact that he said, and remember, Joe Biden is a creature of the Senate. Joe Biden spent 36 years in the Senate and really could be regarded as a Senate institutionalist and someone who worked across the aisle. The fact that he said he would support filibuster reform for voting rights and maybe more, I think was a very, very significant moment and a signal to Democrats that it's time to go ahead with it.
Anita, can we get into something that Cheryl was just alluding to Biden said last night, if I get into the debate on the filibuster, we heard him say, I lose at least three votes to get what I have to get done. Can you explain what he's talking about there, what those three votes are?
Yeah, I think he's referring to, well, let me just back up and say, you know, Joe Biden doesn't determine what the Senate does, but Cheryl's right. He sends such a strong signal to his party if he decides to say, look, I really want to go there. So it's the Democratic Party in the Senate that needs to decide whether they're going to pursue this, right? I mean, he needs to get all these Democrats on board if he wants to remove the filibuster. And we don't yet know, and we believe that they are opposed, that Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema, two moderates in the Senate, are opposed to that. They're a third senator, Angus King, who's actually an independent but caucuses with the Democrats, recently said that he would... he was open to changing the filibuster. So he still got some ways to go here. And that's been the problem with the party in the Senate since the beginning of this administration. There had been so many high hopes by activists and Democrats that they could push all these things through. And as you alluded to earlier, the whole Biden agenda is really hanging on this. You know, it's not just about voting. It's not just about these spending bills that we're going to talk about. It's about police reform and immigration and raising the minimum wage, all these things Joe Biden ran on and Democrats promised to voters that they would get done.
Naftali, what happens next then? Could any of this happen?
Well, it seems unlikely at the moment. I mean, with Biden, sometimes it's hard to tell whether he's getting exuberant and caught up in the moment or whether this actually signifies a policy change. But even if it does, we've got no indication that Joe Manchin or Kristen Sinema are willing to change their views on this. But I think there's this broader point at issue here, which is that a growing number of Democrats are feeling that between the voting rights issues in the state, between the filibusters, gerrymandering, the Electoral College, the Supreme Court as shaped by Mitch McConnell, that the American democratic system isn't reflecting the reality of the sentiments of the people. I mean, ironically, a lot of people in the Republican Party feel like the system's rigged too. But you do have to wonder how long our system can sustain itself when large swaths of people on both sides feel like it's completely unresponsive to their desires.
Cheryl, do you think that's what President Biden was expressing last night?
I think in part, but I also think that this is a very perilous, in a way, moment for the young Biden presidency. The president has promised voters that he was going to do some of these things. He was going to enact, you know, sweeping climate change legislation. He was going to address child care and family leave and all the things that are in this bill. And in the wake of the very, very difficult, to use an understated word, 2020 election, you know, he was going to address voting reforms. He promised the voters all these things. It's almost a year into his presidency. He has got to find a way to deliver on some of these things. And they are getting frustrated in the White House. They need to come through, certainly in enough time for Democrats to go out and campaign in 2022 that they have accomplished what they were elected to do.
Let's talk about voting rights reform. Senate Democrats say voting rights legislation is necessary to curb a wave of voter restrictions taking place in Republican-led states. But Naftali, how are they going to make this federal legislation happen now?
Well, you know, it's interesting. President Biden, in his town hall meeting last night, he was candid for the first time about saying that he hasn't turned his full attention to it because he first had to get through his economic package. It seemed kind of evident, but he's been reluctant to admit it. But what he basically said is, look, let me get these things through, and then I can turn to some of the issues that are really important to Democratic-based voters, to the African-American community that in many ways helped put him in office. And that includes not just voting rights, but also police brutality. So right or wrong, what he said is, look, give me a couple months to get my economic passage through, and then I promise I will throw myself more fully into voting rights and similar issues.
But as he's saying that, this week Texas finalized a series of new redistricting maps, ones that effectively solidify Republican control of the state. The maps also reduce the number of majority Black and Latino districts, despite non-white residents fueling the recent population growth in Texas. So with political gerrymandering still thriving at the state level, how much do you think can be done without federal intervention? intervention.
I mean, that's a real truth. I mean, there is only so much the federal government can do. So much of how voting works is handled at the state level. Now, the administration will tell you that they have doubled the size of the Justice Department's voting rights task force. They've sued the state of Georgia over its voting restrictions bill. And they would say that they're doing what they can to pursue this in courts. And that's another element of this, by the way. The courts have become more conservative and more hostile to what is traditionally seen as voting rights and civil rights in elections cases. And so it's true, I think, that the Democrats are fighting an uphill battle at this point.
Anita, so what do you think comes next in this battle over voting rights?
Well, they did have a procedure yesterday where they sort of left the door open that they could bring this bill back to the floor. But again, I think that nobody was surprised by how it went. It really wasn't the point to pass because they knew they didn't have the vote. So while they can bring that up, while they can still talk about it, it's almost as if they were working on a compromise, as they called it, bill among different factions of the Democratic Party, and a compromise with local officials, you know, some local elections officials, some of who had been worried about some of these, you know, things would be too difficult to implement. So where they are in this federal bill is we're back to what we talked about before, which is they simply do not have anything close to something that the Republicans will agree to. And they need to figure out how they're going to get around that. And that takes us right back to the filibuster.
We'll be back with more of the roundup in just a moment. Remember, to have your questions answered on future topics or to just let us know what you think, tweet us at 1A.
This message comes from Capital One. With the Capital One Venture Card, you earn unlimited double miles on every purchase every day. And you can use those miles toward travel expenses like flights, hotels, rental cars, and more. Just book and pay for your travel using your Venture Card and redeem your miles toward the cost. Capital One. What's in your wallet? Credit approval required. Capital One Bank, USA N.A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Wyzant, a one-to-one tutoring alternative to online classes where you can learn face-to-face online. Get help with tackling new subjects and career skills or just catching up. Wyzant lists thousands of personal instructors in over 300 subjects available for live, individualized lessons with their online learning platform. Head to wyzant.com to find your perfect instructor. Love it or your first hour is free. Because at Wyzant, we take learning personally.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
Now let's get back to discussing some of the week's biggest stories. What prevents a future where a single political party gains complete control of the federal government if the filibuster is no longer honored in the Senate?
Well, first of all, we actually have that situation right now. Democrats are in control of the government. We've had it in the past where Republicans have been, had, you know, both the houses of Congress and the presidency. And, you know, what prevents that future is elections. Every 2 years in this country, we have elections and the voters get to decide. So sometimes we have one party control and sometimes we don't.
I mean, also, it has to be said that virtually every other democracy in the world works that way. I mean, you elect a party and the party controls the executive branch and they control the legislative branch. And some people would say that works a whole lot better than this constant state of dysfunction and dissension that we have right now. The other point is that not that long ago, Obama had a 60-vote majority, a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate and control of the House and control of the White House. And what happened? The Democrats splintered like crazy. They got creamed in the next election. So I think the danger of some kind of a dictatorial control by one party is probably remote.
I do want to go back to the voting reform and just ask you a question. Georgia's Republican Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, recently told Axios that it's time for a bipartisan commission on federal election reform. What is the significance of the proposal and that the fact that it's coming from him?
So I think Raffensperger is a fascinating character. I'm sure your listeners will remember that President Trump leaned on him and told him, find the votes, you know, in Georgia. And he resisted. And he was very outspoken. He sent Congress, I think, a 20-page letter on January 6th, you know, refuting Trump's claims, Trump's lies that the election was stolen. He's got a tough race coming up. this year, next year in 2022, against Jody Heiss, a Georgia congressman who is already has the endorsement of President Trump. And so Raffensperger is in a difficult situation, but I do think he is thinking carefully about elections and about faith in elections. He actually supported the recount in Fulton County, Georgia, saying that he hoped it would restore faith in the electoral process. So I do think that there's maybe some politics there, but also some well-intentioned policy thoughts about how do we get to a place in this country where we have faith in elections, which is the bedrock of our democracy.
You mentioned January 6th. I wanted to turn to the House Select Committee's investigation into the insurrection on January 6th. Yesterday, the House voted in favor of holding Trump ally Steve Bannon in criminal contempt for defying a subpoena to appear before the committee. Cheryl, can you remind us how we got here, first of all?
Well, how we got here, we can have the long story or the short story. The short story is we had the riot on January 6th. Nancy Pelosi created a House Select Committee to investigate. The committee issued some subpoenas, including to Steve Bannon, President Trump's former advisor, who stonewalled the committee and said that he was not going to testify and he was not going to submit any documents. He said he was basically, his lawyer said he was following the direction of the president who was asserting, the former president, who was asserting executive privilege over documents. And Bannon's insistence is that that issue, the issue of whether the former president's documents are privileged, in other words, can be withheld, must be resolved by the courts.
To that point of President Trump claiming executive privilege, the Biden administration has declined to assert executive privilege to protect him. Naftali, what happens with that now?
Well, now it has to be litigated. And I think that's one of the things that the committee is worried about, is that even if they prevail on some of these issues, that this could drag out for a very long time. But these are pretty novel legal arguments. I mean, you have for the first time a former president asserting executive privilege. That hasn't been tested. And also, Steve Bannon was not a government official. He was a private citizen. And also, presumably, what they were discussing, as far as the committee is concerned, is the January 6th attack or insurrection, which is not official government business. And so whether any of that would be subject to executive privilege still has to be fought out in the courts. But, you know, sometimes even when you win in the courts, you lose, because if this drags out for another year, year and a half, that's not going to help the committee in any way.
Anita, back to Steve Bannon. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has signed the resolution to hold him in criminal contempt. And so now it heads to the Justice Department as well as to D.C.'s Attorney General Carl Racine. Where does it go from here?
Yeah, the attorney general really needs to decide sort of what's next. And he hasn't really tipped his hand on whether he would want to move ahead with charges or not. He's just basically said they'll look at the case and they'll determine, you know, what needs to be done from here. But still, you know, as you all indicated here, this, you know, this doesn't resolve this case. This is one particular issue. It could take a while for this situation, even if he's charged, to get resolved. And it's rarely invoked, and it rarely leads to jail time. So, you know, is this just an issue that where it's going to just, you know, there's still, this committee is still not going to get the information it's asking for? That's probably really likely. This is going to take a while, and it's just not clear that they're going to get the information from Steve Bannon. So they are, of course, looking at a variety of other people, other very close confidants to former President Trump.
Anita, did we get any clues from Attorney General Garland's testimony or appearance yesterday on the Hill about how he would handle this?
No, we really didn't. And it was, you know, interesting timing because, of course, he was going to be asked about this. And he basically, you know, sort of has said what he's always said, I think. You know, the attorney general's in a tough spot because he has a lot of people and a lot of politicians on whatever the issue is, sort of pushing him to do something. And of course, we saw in the last 4 years during the Trump administration where the president and some of his key advisors was always, you know, on big cases telling DOJ and the attorney, various attorney generals, people that had that job, what to do. You know, of course, the White House has said, look, we're going to stay out of it. But this White House, the Biden White House, but it has been interesting that they may have said, you know, President Biden has said how important this this investigation is, that he wants to know what happened on January 6th. And he's actually come out and said people need to be held accountable if they're not providing information. It was one of the reasons that the Biden White House decided, look, that we're not going to invoke executive privilege. We need, you know, to know what happened that day and that this committee should go ahead. So the attorney general has a lot of pressure from a lot of different people on what he's going to do. But again, this isn't going to resolve it. This isn't going to tell us everything that we want to know about January 6th. It's going to put in place this process, but we still might not see some of those documents for a while.
Between holding Steve Bannon in criminal contempt and Trump's lawsuit, we are in this period of uncharted waters around this issue of secrecy powers. Naftali, what do you make of, as you said, you sort of alluded to this, these legal challenges? These are also kind of existential questions.
They are. They absolutely are. And I think one of the things that we're seeing with the committee is just like you saw the narrative of the January 6th attack being rewritten in real time. I mean, we all saw an attack on the Capitol to overturn an election. And suddenly it's become, in certain quarters, a patriotic act. And the real travesty, President Trump will tell you, was on Election Day. But we all saw what happened. And I think similarly, we're seeing this committee that was formed without any Republican agreement to participate to investigate the direction is somehow being transformed to this political insider group of Washingtonians going after these loyal patriots who want nothing more than to protect the country. And so I think there's a bigger battle for the perception here and for the narrative. And I think that's a lot of what's going on.
I think we're also seeing the solidification of the dual narratives that Naftali talks about. One Republican, Liz Cheney, is involved with this committee. And we saw this week that her advisors, her consultants have been told, you know, by Republican leaders to break with her, to ditch her. So we're seeing that Republicans as a party are firmly in the camp of Trump and misrepresenting what happened on January 6th. And Democrats as a party are firmly in the camp of investigating it and never the twain shall meet.
Representative Kinzinger is also Republican on that committee, right? And also yesterday, both of them did also vote yesterday to hold Steve Bannon.
Both of them did. They were among, I think, 9 Republicans. Fred Upton and some others also broke with the party.
Let's turn to President Biden's agenda. Last night, he did speak at a CNN town hall with the hopes of garnering support for some of his more ambitious goals. Anita, we have already talked about the filibuster reform, but what were the highlights from last night's town hall?
Well, it was kind of interesting. So those of us have been following President Biden, he was sort of uncharacteristically open about it. So what's been happening is that he's been having a lot of talks in person, on the phone with members of Congress trying to hash out this deal. And what he told people at the CNN town hall is some of the details. And he acknowledged at that town hall that, yes, this bill that he's been pushing, and if you'll recall, this was $6 trillion at one point, and then $3 trillion, you know, is going to get smaller. And he talked about, he talked about some of the things that are going to come out. He told us that there are about 4 or 5 issues that they're still trying to work through. And he also really pointed the finger and said, look, we've got these moderate senators. He mentioned Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema again. There are certain things that they don't agree to. So he has talked about some of those things that are going to have to come out. And it was really our first opportunity here from the president that, look, I'm going to scale this back. It's going to happen, he says. But he also says, look, compromise, I think his exact words is people think this is a dirty word, but actually this is what has to happen in Washington to get anything done. And that's what we're doing here.
We're talking to Politico's Anita Kumar, Naftali Ben-David of The Washington Post, and Cheryl Gay Stolberg of The New York Times. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to 1A. And before we move on, tributes to former Secretary of State Colin Powell have poured in all week. The general died on Monday of complications from COVID-19. He had been fully vaccinated, but treatment for a rare form of cancer had compromised his immune system. We spoke to history professor Leah Wright Rigour about what he meant to black voters and the Republican Party.
He was often the voice of reason when it came to racial issues and a number of other social issues. So for him, he had no problem kind of navigating what we might call the tricky terrain of a modern American politics, because it was so much a part of who he was in terms of identity.
Powell served under 5 different administrations. He was also the country's first Black national security advisor, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Secretary of State. But his historic legacy was marred by the war in Iraq, including his appearance before the UN, convincing them weapons of mass destruction were a major threat. Those weapons never materialized. Democrats are still negotiating a sweeping reconciliation budget deal to address some of the party's major priorities. The social policy package was originally priced at $3.5 trillion, but at least $1.5 trillion has already been knocked off that price tag. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi spoke to reporters on Thursday about what Democrats are trying to do now with this bill.
We're narrowing what the possibilities are as we see what we need to cover, because the bill will be paid for. And so, what are the choices that will be made?
So those choices include everything on this deal: climate change, child care, health care, education, and more. But the support isn't there for how much all of this is going to cost. Anita, what's been dropped from the plan so far?
Well, again, it's still a work in progress. We're looking at possibly seeing some of those details this weekend. But the things that he mentioned and that we've heard about are limiting the duration of the expanded child tax credit to 1 year. They had talked about more years than that. President Biden also said yesterday that this would no longer provide free community college. I would note that his wife is a community college teacher, so that was kind of striking. But he did mention that he hopes to increase Pell Grants to compensate for the loss of that. They had also talked about having 12 weeks of family leave, but that's going to be just 4 weeks right now. And of course, there were some issues, a lot of issues, with his big clean energy proposal. That was something that Senator Manchin of West Virginia had really had an issue with. And so they're focusing now, of course, this could change, on providing at least $500 billion in tax credits and grants and loans for energy producers that reach certain emission reduction goals.
As you mentioned, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, Kristen Sinema of Arizona. Naftali, has this week given us any more insight into what those two want?
I think it has. And not only this week, but, you know, it's funny, as somebody who, you know, covers the White House, I mean, we've spent weeks and months trying to get inside these negotiations and get details, and it's been hard. And Biden just kind of spouted all of them last night. I mean, whether that's
classic Joe Biden.
Yeah, whether that's endearing or alarming, I'm not sure, but it was a real change. And
what did we learn from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, we learned very specifically, that Joe Manchin just was not interested in the climate portion, and that Kristen Sinema is not interested in corporate tax increases. So it's not just that the Democrats have two dissenters. It's they have two dissenters who want completely different things. And it's pretty clear that the climate plan is going to be greatly scaled back, and it's pretty clear that corporate taxes are not going to be increased. So that is a real sort of step forward in terms of knowing how these things are going to go. But it's still notable, though, that I think the default now, most people would think, is that we're going to get a deal, whereas maybe a week ago, the default was that it was going to fall apart. There's just a sense that Democrats, you know, they're grieving over this in a way, because this could be their last chance to pass their agenda for years. But after moving through denial and anger, in a way, they're now in bargaining. And so you get a sense that they will perhaps end up with something. And that's a pretty significant change in the dynamic.
Anita, is that something around $2 trillion at this point?
Yeah, that's right. That's what they're looking at. I mean, I would note that if we didn't know how much they wanted in the beginning, or if we hadn't talked about $6 trillion and $3 trillion at different points, $2 trillion, this package is going to be, if they get it done, significant. It is going to have a lot of things in there, and it's a significant amount of money, and there's a lot of things that Joe Biden and Democrats wanted. It's that we're comparing it, of course, to this much bigger plan, and some of the very key things that President Biden and Democrats campaigned on, worked for, said they would do, are not going to be in here. So when you compare that, it doesn't look as significant as we once were talking about a few months ago. And you all just mentioned one of those key things. Remember, President Biden campaigned on the tax cut situation. The tax situation, he wanted to roll back what President Trump did and Congress did during President Trump's term on these tax breaks for the wealthy and corporations. And that looks like it's just not going to happen. And that was a key promise of President Biden.
You're listening to the News Roundup. A reminder, you can join future conversations. Just download our 1A Vox Pop app and leave us a voicemail. We'll be back with more from you and our guests in just a moment.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Best Fiends. When it comes to match three style puzzle games, only one reigns supreme, Best Fiends. It's an action-packed adventure game and puzzle game rolled into one, so it's no wonder it's got so many five-star reviews. Plus, there's new content added all the time. If you're tired of crushing the same old candy, give Best Fiends a try. You can download Best Fiends free on the App Store or Google Play Store. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
It's the News Roundup. Let's get back to the conversation. Anita, I did want to get back to one thing that you were mentioning just before the break, which is that Senate Democrats have scaled back a plan to crack down on tax cheating after privacy concerns were raised by conservative groups. Can you tell us what was in this original proposal and what privacy concerns Republicans raised?
Well, Republicans, I think you're referring to the IRS. I'm not sure.
Correct, yes.
Cracking down. Yeah, they've had, you know, there's been a variety of things that they have said about this. This is, you know, it's funny. I've talked to a lot of Republicans about this. There have been a lot of criticisms about this issue. I still think some part of this is still going to be in this bill and they're going to move forward with it. But Republicans still remember back to the days. All of them told me this during the President Obama's term, where there was some issue where they felt that the IRS was cracking down on conservative groups. It seems like so long ago, but actually, if you'll remember, they were targeting political groups, so it wasn't just conservative groups. It's sort of like something still in the back of their mind that they're just thinking that the IRS is not fair and that you don't want to do this. They have raised, as you said, privacy. They've raised that this is partisan. They've raised a lot of issues that they say this is just not the way to go. And actually, if you've seen there've been ads against some of these members of Congress talking about this issue. Several groups have latched onto it. So it's one of those things that sort of comes up every time this issue comes up. Can we crack down on tax cheats? Republicans just don't trust the IRS, and that's sort of where we are.
And so, Naftali, what does the plan look like now if the Biden administration has spent so much time talking about cracking down on particularly wealthy tax evaders?
Yeah, and it was supposed to be an important source of revenue for this overall package, by the way. But the initial proposal was going to be to require banks to give the IRS data for accounts where there were transactions of $600 or more in the course of a year. But Republicans complained that a lot of innocent people would be targeted and somehow the IRS would have information on people who hadn't done anything wrong. So now that's been up to $10,000. So if there are transactions of $10,000 or more in somebody's account, to make it clear, this doesn't count wages. This is other kinds of transactions. Then that would raise a red flag. It would go to the IRS and they'd be able to look into it a little bit more.
Cheryl, I did want to pick up also one more point about President Biden's town hall last night. He made some interesting statements about Medicare.
He did. He, you know, there's a lot of healthcare provisions in this bill. The bill would, or Democrats would like the bill to include a provision allowing them to negotiate, the government to negotiate drug prices, for Medicare to negotiate drug prices. It would include a provision to expand Medicare to cover vision, dental, and hearing. And it would also include a provision that would expand or end what we know as the Medicaid coverage gap, the 3-some-odd million people in this country who don't qualify for Medicaid but also don't qualify for Obamacare because 12 states have refused to expand Medicaid. The president said something really significant about Medicare expansion last night. He said it would be a reach to include dental, vision, and hearing coverage for Medicare, that instead he was thinking about an $800 voucher for people, for Medicare recipients, to cover dental care. And this is really a blow to progressives. Led by Bernie Sanders, progressives have really been arguing strongly that dental care, vision care, hearing care are an essential component of health care, that Medicare needs to cover them. Many elderly people, for instance, cannot afford very expensive hearing aids. And to hear Biden say that this would be a reach kind of signaled a death knell to that expansive provision, or at least a severe narrowing of it.
Something else that's dropping out from that $3.5 trillion, in other words.
Right.
Speaking of healthcare, let's turn to COVID. The White House has rolled out a plan to offer the Pfizer vaccine to children as young as 5. So far, the FDA has not yet approved a vaccine for kids that young, but Biden administration officials say they believe one's coming in the next few weeks. Pfizer has reported that a lower dose of its vaccine was nearly 91% effective in preventing symptomatic COVID-19 during clinical trials. Naftali, how will this differ from the initial vaccine rollout 10 months ago? The White House did spend some time talking about this special plan for kids this week.
Yeah, the initial rollout, as I'm sure we all remember, featured these mass vaccination sites where stadiums were turned into facilities for people to get their shots. This isn't going to be anything like that. I think one part of it is that people are very sensitive, of course, about the health of their kids. And it wouldn't surprise me if a lot of people are reluctant or resistant to getting their kids vaccinated, particularly kids as young as 5. So it's going to be handled much more through pediatricians' offices and places like that. But I think, you know, the administration's trying to regain the initiative in this whole vaccination issue. I mean, it started out as this huge success story where people were getting vaccinated by the scores and numbers went up. And then, of course, the resistance set in and there was a pushback. And I think what the White House would really like is to try to give a final push, get some final momentum on this, and perhaps try to wrap up the pandemic for good in the next few months.
Cheryl, do we know what percentage of America's unvaccinated population are children who don't currently qualify for the vaccine?
Well, we know that 28 million, there are 28 million 5 to 11-year-olds. So that's what? There's some a little bit more than 330 million Americans. So I guess less than 10% of the population. That's a really, really important part of the American population. Kids are essential to ending this pandemic, getting kids vaccinated. And it's going to be tough. The administration is really going to face an uphill climb. We know that the lower the age group, the less likely people are to be vaccinated. Some 75% of people older than 65 are vaccinated. When you get down to 15 to 16-year-olds, it's roughly half the population, maybe even a little bit less. And as Naftali rightly mentioned, many parents are going to be wary of getting their young children vaccinated. Another thing to note, it's Pfizer that has asked for FDA approval for children. Moderna, the other mRNA vaccine, is quite far behind as regulators examine effects of heart effects of its vaccine in some adolescents. So we're really looking at least for the time being, if the FDA approves the Pfizer vaccine. An FDA panel will consider this next week, and then the agency could be expected to act within days.
What do we know from the data from the clinical trials about the safety of this for children?
Well, we know what Pfizer reported today is that it is 90.7% effective with few side effects for young people. But like I said, the Moderna vaccine has had some concerning side effects for young adolescents, particularly young boys.
And that's the heart.
That is the heart. It's myocarditis. It's an inflammation of the heart. I should say that in children or adolescents and young adults who've experienced it, it is resolved quickly. It's not life-threatening or permanent, but it's nonetheless scary, and especially scary for parents thinking about vaccinating their kids. But it is also scary for parents to think about their kids going to school and bringing home COVID and perhaps exposing elderly people. Colin Powell is a great example, what happened with him. He is a great argument for why young people and kids need to get vaccinated so this virus stops spreading and affecting those vulnerable to it.
Naftali, what is the White House trying to do to address this issue of hesitancy among parents, given what we've already seen with how the rollout has gone for the 12 to 18-year-olds?
Well, they've talked a lot about having things like, you know, trusted messengers. You know, they realize that when they go out and advocate that people do this, there's a lot of nervousness, particularly because, as we know, kids often don't have severe symptoms. So I think parents sometimes weigh the cost benefit and they're like, well, if my kid's not going to get super sick from this thing and there's a risk of getting vaccinated, then maybe I should skip the vaccine. And so they're trying to communicate with pediatricians and with sort of trusted medical advisors to try to change the course in this thing. But I do think it's going to be an uphill battle. And I think the administration has recognized that there's a ceiling to the number of people that they can get vaccinated right now. And there's a lot of talk, of course, as well about boosters. And some of the messaging around the boosters has been fairly complex and I think difficult for a lot of people to follow. I mean, I think one of the problems that the administration's facing is that they have a lot of messengers. They have Fauci, who's out there and very well known. They have the FDA, which has, of course, does not even have a leader and hasn't had one for the entire Biden administration. You know, they have the CDC led by Rochelle Walensky, whose messaging has not always been great. They have Jeff Zients at the White House. They have Javier Becerra, the HHS secretary, who almost never seems to talk about this. So I think the one thing that they're trying to improve on, but has been a challenge for them, is just the flat out messaging. And I think the same could probably be expected on the kids' vaccines.
Right. So this week, the CDC did endorse Moderna and Johnson & Johnson booster shots. And the FDA has okayed a mix and match booster policy, which means your booster shot could be a different brand than your original vaccine. To that point of boosters, Anita, originally the White House wanted anyone to be eligible. What does it say that the qualifying age range may already be dropping?
Yeah, I think you're referring to there's some talk about some reporting, I think, from CNN that they could be talking about.
I'm sorry, yes, as young as 40, right,
could be 40 years old. Mm-hmm. Right now it's 65 and older, I believe. And then also, of course, some people that have health issues that would make them, you know, more susceptible, as well as people in certain jobs. You know, they're talking about that. This just goes back to the messaging. It has been very, very confusing. What happened, of course, is that the White House said some time ago that, look, everybody's going to get a booster. Everybody should get a booster, and that's what's going to happen. And then that's not what happened, right? This is an administration that said they would follow the science. They very much criticize the Trump administration for not doing that. They say that, you know, all the time, really. I think the president even said it last night at his town hall meeting. So this is an administration that says they're going to follow the science. And then, of course, these people that were, you know, the FDA and others that were looking at what should be done didn't push what the White House said. Not everybody is eligible to get a booster. And so I think this just goes to show that, you know, they can't get out in front of things. That really did confuse things. So now you've mentioned this mix and match. There are going to be other people. There are people that could now get Moderna and J&J. When they talked about this, they said, look, this was interesting. I didn't even realize this, that people don't really know. And of course, I don't think most people know this, what flu shot they get. And so it's unreasonable for them to know what vaccine, what COVID vaccine they might have gotten, and so that they could get something different. So if you got J&J, you could get Moderna or something like that. It's interesting because we don't carry around in our wallets or whatever a card that tells us, I think that tells us which COVID vaccine we got. We don't have that for the flu shots. But they still think that majority of people will probably get the same booster of what they originally got. But they hope that this opens the door to other people to say, look, I want to go get one now.
Cheryl, you wanted to weigh in here on the boosters.
I was just going to say that actually people do carry cards around in their wallets.
It says on my
wallets.
Card. I was going to say on my...
Well, it says on your card, but I think...
For the
COVID-19,
right.
Anita was referring to flu. But the with respect to the boosters, frankly, this mix and match strategy is something that we could see coming all along. It's the result of a study, a federally funded study, that found that people who got a single Johnson & Johnson shot and then had a Moderna booster saw their antibodies level rise 76-fold in 15 days, compared with just a 4-fold increase after J&J. I talked with Dr. Fauci a couple weeks ago, and he told me then that he is really convinced that the correct coursing or the correct dosing for these vaccines is for the Johnson & Johnson. He believes it's a 2-dose course, just like a hepatitis A vaccine is. And for the Pfizer and Moderna, which are the mRNA vaccines, he strongly believes, based on data coming out of Israel, that the correct course is two shots within a couple weeks or a few weeks of each other, and then a boost. So the science has been building toward these recommendations.
And does this mix and match help state officials as we're thinking about rollout?
I think it does help state officials, and it also does help doctors and patients, because look, not everybody does know. I carry a card with my vaccination in it. I'm a health policy reporter. You would expect that. But not everybody knows what shot they got. And also, some people might have had, say, a reaction to the Pfizer shot. Maybe they had a sore arm or flu-like symptoms. So they think, well, I'd rather go with Moderna this time. So it just gives that added flexibility to patients and doctors.
I want to get to one last story before we wrap up the hour. San Francisco, it's about vaccine mandates, and San Francisco requiring proof of vaccination for all restaurants and bars. Well, this week, it shut down its only In-N-Out location because staff members weren't checking diners' vaccine statuses. Naftali, if we think about this, In-N-Out has 366 locations across 7 states. The mandate situation in Texas is very different from San Francisco. How do national companies handle this?
I mean, I do have to think that the In-N-Out store incident was an outlier. I mean, we have also, you know, General Electric saying it's going to vaccinate all of its people. We have New York City saying it's going to vaccinate all of its people. I think the larger story is that the mandates have by and large worked, and that the mass resignations that some people predicted didn't happen. We're talking about one store in one city that temporarily closed and is now reopened, albeit not to indoor dining. So while I think it's a really interesting story and shows the cultural clash, it's not indicative of the larger trend.
And in fact, it shows that the vaccine mandate, to your mind, are working.
I believe so. Yeah, I think the evidence shows that.
That's Naftali Ben-David, a White House editor at The Washington Post. I want to thank Anita Kumar, senior editor of Standards and Ethics at Politico, and Cheryl Gay Stolberg, a Washington correspondent covering health policy at The New York Times. Remember to subscribe to the 1-8 podcast. It's where you'll find our best guests and stories every day. 1A's audio engineer and sound designer is Mike Kidd. He gets technical assistance from Rashad Young. Aileen Humphreys is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand. Chris Castano is our digital editor. You're listening to the News Roundup. We'll discuss the week's biggest headlines from around the world in just a moment. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
We're rounding up the week's biggest headlines from around the globe. It's the international edition of the News Roundup. You're listening to the 1A podcast. Question. Would the United States defend Taiwan if China attacked? Last night, President Biden said it would.
I don't want a cold war with China. I just want to make China understand that we are not going to step back. We are not going to change any of our views.
So are you saying that the United States would come to Taiwan's defense if China attacked?
Yes, we have a commitment to do that.
Which sounded to most like a departure from America's policy of, quote, strategic ambiguity. His comments were later walked back by a White House spokesperson who said his remarks did not signify a change in policy. Taiwan is just one of a range of international issues confronting the Biden administration, and we'll get to a lot of them in the next hour. My guests this week are Indira Lakshmanan, senior executive editor at National Geographic. Indira, it's great to have you back.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you, Nyla.
Jennifer Williams, deputy editor at Foreign Policy and host of the podcast The Negotiators. Jennifer, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Joyce Cottom, senior correspondent for The National. Joyce, welcome back.
Thanks, Nyla.
In a video released on Thursday, the leader of a gang who kidnapped 17 American and Canadian missionaries in Haiti has said he'll kill them if his demands aren't met. The gang is demanding a $17 million ransom for their safe return. Jen, what efforts are underway to rescue them that we know of?
So as far as we know, the U.S. has sent a team involving several different agencies, including the State Department and the FBI. And they sent a team on the ground in Haiti to try to figure out how to resolve this. Now, you have to remember, of course, the U.S. has a policy of not, you know, paying ransom for hostages. So there is the challenge there. But this is something that is, you know, the United States has dealt with in many countries for many years. And so there are ways to kind of back channel this essentially and get around that and figure out, you know, is there going to be some sort of just negotiation? This gang in particular, the 400 Mawozo gang, has done this a lot. They are responsible for something like over 80% of the kidnappings in Haiti. They have negotiated in previous kidnappings with the people who are trying to secure the release of the hostages and come down on their price, if you will. So, you know, there are ways for them to negotiate, but it is really disturbing, this video that came out of them, you know, very clearly threatening, saying, if I don't get what I want, you know, I'll kill every single one of them. I'd rather do that than not get what I want. So, of course, that's a tactic, right, in negotiation. That's the whole point, is they're holding these people hostage in order to get money. That's how this gang and others like it in Haiti operate. They basically function through extortion. They have checkpoints that they set up. They control, you know, neighborhoods. They shake down local officials, just local residents. It seems like this bus that these missionaries were on was stopped at one of these checkpoints, and that's when they were taken hostage. So, you know, again, this is a common thing, as horrifying as that is. I think everyone is really, really hoping and praying that there is a peaceful resolution to this and that the hostages are released safely.
To your point, the White House hasn't said much about what it's doing, citing operational sensitivities, but the White House press secretary was asked if it was aware of this demand made by kidnappers for $17 million. And Jen Psaki did tell people, to your point, Jen, the U.S. does not negotiate with those who hold people hostage.
That remains our policy, and I can't get into too many details operationally here because that's has never been in the interest of bringing people home who are being held for ransom. But kidnapping is widespread, and victims regularly include U.S. citizens. We know these groups target U.S. citizens who they assume have the resources and finances to pay ransoms, even if that is not the case.
Jen, do we know what role the FBI is playing here, even if the White House obviously isn't going to be discussing it?
Yeah, I mean, not particularly beyond just, you know, the resources that the FBI has, the experience that the FBI has in terms of hostage negotiations, right? They are the people who typically handle this kind of thing also domestically. And so they will be, you know, meeting with government officials. They will be meeting with, you know, with the Haitian officials. You know, the Haitian government has previously paid ransoms to, including this gang, to secure the release of other hostages. And so it's certainly possible that they could kind of go through the Haitian government and say that the U.S. didn't negotiate this, right, that the U.S. didn't pay. Because, again, going back to that policy, the idea behind that is that, well, if the U.S., it's known that the U.S. will pay every time you take an American citizen hostage, well, then there's a lot more incentive to keep taking American citizens hostage, right? So, you know, the FBI has a lot of experience with this. The State Department is also obviously on the ground there, you know, for the diplomatic piece of this. But there's a lot of, you know, history of law enforcement cooperation and, you know, collaboration between the U.S. and the Haitian government. And so bringing in those kind of law enforcement resources to be able to figure out, you know, first of all, just locating where they're holding the hostages. In previous kidnappings they've done, they tend to move the hostages around, you know, every few days to try to keep them from being, you know, found by the authorities. The authorities themselves are often co-opted by these gangs in Haiti. And so that's another reason why the FBI being there, you know, is potentially helpful to bring the kind of more independent resources to bear.
Jen, it's a good reminder also that if the U.S. government doesn't negotiate for hostages, other governments do. I wonder if we can step back a minute. Joyce, I know that kidnappings have been a problem in Haiti and have been on the rise in the last year. Can you tell us a little bit more about what's been happening?
No, absolutely, Naila. Gangs and kidnapping, they're just becoming a way of common life, a way of doing business in Haiti. The only reason we're hearing about this right now, it's because it involves U.S. citizens, U.S. humanitarian missionary organization, and a Canadian citizen. But the country itself is a chaotic place. It's a desperately poor country where we have seen a complete breakdown of law and order. In Haiti itself, gangs have more power than the state. I mean, you know, gangs control up to 40% of Port-au-Prince, the capital, and the street that belonged to that group, the 400 Mawozo is where the missionary group got kidnapped. The group itself, the 400 Mawozo, translates to 400 inexperienced men, was responsible for 80% of abductions in Haiti from June through September. So we're talking about a very difficult situation. I'm honestly not sure there are many good options for the United States here except negotiating.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a difficult situation, Joyce.
Could go to the Security Council, but then and threaten to send a UN force, but that hasn't worked in the past. So the options we're looking at here is negotiating with the group, paying some kind of ransom indirectly, as Jen mentioned, either through the Haitian government or others, but. But this is, a way of living. This is a way of how these gangs do money, and they've been
targeting. And it sounds like it's just become a way of life, unfortunately, in Haiti. Indira, can I ask you about, according to Christian Aid Ministries, the 17 missionaries come from Amish, Mennonite, and other conservative Christian communities across the U.S. and Ontario. They include two young teenagers, a 6-year-old, a 3-year-old, and an infant. Do we know if these missionaries were specifically targeted?
Well, they were coming back from an orphanage when they were grabbed and taken hostage. But I'd like to sort of, the reason this is in the U.S. news now is because these are largely American people and one Canadian. But I don't want us to lose sight of the larger context, which is that at least 782 people have been kidnapped in Haiti between the start of the year and October 16th, when these folks were kidnapped. That includes 50 foreign nationals, but the vast majority of that number are obviously Haitians. So these gangs, these criminal gangs, are taking Haitians of all walks of life. You don't have to be rich and you don't have to be foreign, and extorting money from them, including taking entire buses hostage, just stopping the road, taking everybody on the entire public bus hostage until their families, no matter how poor they are, pay something. So, I mean, I think it's important to see this in the larger context, which is that this has just been a 1-2-3 punch for Haiti, a country that already is one of the poorest in the Western Hemisphere and has had one problem after another since this summer. Don't forget, there was the assassination of the president, Jovenel Moïse, on July 7th. That's still unresolved. We don't know who killed him. We had in August a terrible earthquake that left thousands of people homeless and killed people as well.
And Indira, we heard about gang activity then after the earthquake. I wonder, when we think about the fact that at various points in Haitian history, there have been UN and American troops doing peacekeeping duties, that's, of course, not without its own controversy and its own set of problems. Is that being discussed again?
It certainly is. I mean, there have been peaceful protests all across the country this week. This, the seizing of the Christian missionaries is just the latest straw on the camel's back. But the UN peacekeeping mission that you're referring to, which is known as MINUSTAH, left the country in 2018. It was there a long time, over many years, many trips I made to Haiti as a reporter. I met with the MINUSTAH people, and they were not popular. Because there were all sorts of problems, from disease to corruption to abuse, that came in. I mean, there's a much larger story about the American involvement in Haiti for more than a century, from an invasion in 1915. So it's a long history and a very complicated and painful one.
In 2015, the world agreed to a set of lofty climate goals to curtail global warming as part of the Paris Agreement. 6 years later, a new UN report out this week found that some of those same governments actually have plans to produce more fossil fuels in the near future, not less. That includes the United States. Jen, what did we learn from this report?
Yeah, so this is the 2021 Production Gap Report. It was released Wednesday. This is a report by leading research institutes and the UN Environment Program. They provided profiles of 15 major fossil fuel producing companies. And the point of this report is to really examine the gap, right? What is the gap between what countries are actually doing to cut their fossil fuel production and, you know, the actual targets that they've all, you know, these lofty targets that you mentioned, they've all agreed to try to hit in terms of reducing their global emissions. So what the report actually found was that over the next two decades, governments are actually projecting an increase in global oil and gas production and then just a modest decrease in coal production. So it's really, really bad sign. There were a bunch of different findings, get into the details, but one of them that was pretty striking was that countries have directed over $3 billion in new funds toward fossil fuel activities just since the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, and that's far more than they've directed toward clean energy. So what this report really shows us is that despite, you know, all the efforts and, you know, the Paris Agreement, all these, you know, really ambitious targets that scientists say are not even as ambitious as they potentially should be, right? But that we have to hit these targets in order to prevent the most catastrophic effects of climate change. We're already seeing many of these catastrophic effects, but to prevent the absolute kind of, you know, apocalyptic outcome, we have to hit these targets. And what we're seeing is that countries are not only, you know, not going as far enough, they're actually increasing production of fossil fuels. It's a really, really grim sign of how far we still have to go, and especially in advance of the upcoming climate summit.
Jen, who are the world's biggest polluters?
So the United States is right up there at the top. This report looked at a whole bunch of the oil-producing countries, so it wasn't quite looking at who are the most polluting, but rather who are the ones who produce the most fossil fuels. And so there's a bit of a difference, and actually that's part of the challenge that many climate scientists and activists see, is that a lot of the attention is on the polluters. So United States, China, India, et cetera, the UK is also one. But there's also the producers like the U.S., Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, South Africa. There are lots of producers, Russia, of course. And there's less attention on the producers. And they tend to focus on the people who are buying the energy and then using that and then creating that pollution. And so a lot of efforts are now being made by activists and climate scientists to try to put the emphasis back on the producers, saying, yes, you may not be, doing the polluting, but you are producing. Norway in particular is one that doesn't do a lot of polluting itself, but does a lot of the production and sale of the fossil fuels. So what they're trying to kind of focus on is like, look, we need to stop taking this stuff out of the ground because that is going to be used and then that pollution, from that energy. And so trying to move away from the production side of it, not just the consumption and pollution side.
Which will, of course, be the topic when many world leaders gather soon in Glasgow at COP26, which is a major United Nations climate summit. Here's how UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson described the importance of this moment during a speech at the UN last month.
We are doing such irreversible damage that long before a million years are up, we will have made this beautiful planet effectively uninhabitable, not just for us, but for many other species. And that is why the Glasgow COP26 summit is the turning point for humanity. We must limit the rise in temperatures, whose appalling effects were visible even this summer, to 1.5 degrees. We must come together in a collective coming of age.
Those meetings start October 31st. Indira, do we expect that this meeting will be a turning point?
Look, every year, if we look back at the history of global climate negotiations, there have been many moments that at the time we thought were going to be big turning points. 24 years ago, believe it or not, I covered COP3, which was in Kyoto, Japan. And it was a moment when John Kerry, now the U.S. climate envoy, was at the time still a senator from Massachusetts. And I remember interviewing him on the floor of the negotiations there, which went all night long with countries coming together to finally eke out some pretty weak sauce pledges. At the time, we thought that was a big breakthrough. At the time of the Rio talks, we thought that was a big breakthrough. In 2015, when the world's countries got together and finally agreed on the Paris Accord, that seemed to be a big breakthrough. The problem is, every time these watershed moments happen,
emissions, carbon emissions, continue to rise. The only dip we saw was last year, and that was because of COVID and because of global lockdowns. So production and consumption had decreased. But they're back up again this year in 2021. And I would really point listeners to, we did a terrific story a couple weeks ago with some major climate scientists and leaders, including Catherine Hayhoe from Texas Tech and Catherine Wilkinson, who, you know, talking about what is at stake now. Is this year, because of the incredible, horrible events we have seen in weather, you know, fires, floods, all sorts of global climate change induced weather crises. We thought this might be a turning point year. I don't see it. At this point, we have Xi Jinping of China not planning to go. We have
Vladimir Putin, correct? Putin, so how big of a deal is it that those two are not there, Indira?
It's a huge deal, but let's not understate that many other people are not going to be there either. India's leader has not confirmed that he'll be there. You know, Japan's leader can't be there because he has elections on October 31st. So many of the key countries are not going to be in the room. And let's not forget that being in the room matters. The people who make these decisions, it's not just the negotiators, the climate negotiators, it's the presidents and prime ministers of these countries. And remember that great story back in 2009, when at a climate conference in Copenhagen, then President Barack Obama and then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton crashed a meeting where the Chinese premier was meeting secretly with the Brazilian, Indian, and other leaders. And because they crashed that meeting, they were able to pressure agreements out of them. But if you're not there, if you're not in the room, how are these commitments going to happen? I mean, and it's not an understatement to say that what is at stake in Glasgow is the fate of our planet. I mean, it is for us at National Geographic, it's a huge story. It's something we're covering every TikTok moment of. And, you know, if we're going to keep the climate rise in temperature to 1.5 degrees Celsius over pre-industrial levels, we are right now at this point nowhere near that. As this, you know, as this report that Jen was talking about found, by 2030, the world's nations are actually planning to produce 240% more coal, 57% more oil, 71% more natural gas than would be needed to keep the climate rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius.
And in fact, documents leaked to the BBC show also how some countries are actually trying to change a key climate report and downplay the need to move away from fossil fuels. Jennifer Morgan is the executive director of Greenpeace International, and she told the BBC, "We should all know more about those who are working hard to actually make these climate talks fail."
I'm worried, but I also find that this type of information is key to have out there, because the other countries, the world leaders who are there, the vulnerable countries, they need to see what they're up against, and they need to fight even harder for the outcome to keep the 1.5 degrees goal in sight and to have emissions and phase out fossil fuel emissions. And hopefully this will empower them to do so.
Joyce, what's going on with this BBC reporting that in fact shows there are countries who are actively working against this?
The BBC leak is very significant because they give insight on how these governments say one thing in public, host green initiative events, and then they do another thing in private. I mean, the BBC, what they obtained is 32,000 submissions by governments, companies, lobby groups trying to remove recommendations that the world needs to phase out fossil fuels. It also, Naila, offers a peek into the power of the coal and fossil fuel lobbying industries and the power they have in shaping, UN meetings and documents over basic science. So what it tells us is, when it comes to countries like Australia, Saudi Arabia, India, Japan, there is a big pushback to play down to the need to move away from coal and fossil fuel dependency. I mean, some of these countries, Australia and India, were just ravaged by floods and wildfires, but their governments, their companies are just basically ignoring that and pushing in a different direction.
In Syria's capital of Damascus, 14 people were killed in a bus bombing on Wednesday. The bus was carrying Syrian troops. It was one of the deadliest attacks in the city's recent history. Jennifer, conflict in Syria is still ongoing between the government and insurgents in other parts of the country, but we haven't seen attacks like this in Damascus. That's been pretty rare. So what do we know about this?
Right. That's what's actually really surprising and disturbing about this particular attack. So we've seen lots of attacks on army vehicles in eastern Syria previously by suspected ISIS militants who still operate in that kind of really remote desert area. But as you said, attacks in Damascus itself are more rare. You remember, you know, Bashar al-Assad has retaken control in particular of Damascus. It is, you know, basically a regime stronghold. So the ability of, you know, militants, suspected ISIS militants, probably likely behind that, we, you know, don't know for sure. But the fact that they were able to pull off this attack really sends a message that, look, you haven't gotten rid of us yet. We are still able to attack right in the heart of your stronghold. We still have these capabilities. And that definitely sends a very clear message to Assad. It sends a message to the military. And I think it's just a really disturbing development that we've seen. And I think, you know, more broadly, it's a reminder that even though the Assad regime, backed by Russia and Iran, has managed to claw back control of huge swaths of the country, the war is not over. The fighting is not over. This conflict is not over. There, you know, the regime is still fighting. They launched airstrikes that killed many people this week as well. We also saw, of course, the drone strike on the Al Tanf air base, U.S. base in that region in the in Syria, where U.S. forces were originally there to fight and to help train soldiers to fight the ISIS militants there. Now it is much more related to keeping Iran's influence out of the region and trying to push back against some of the Iranian-backed militias that operate there and move frequently on that actual road between Iraq and Syria back and forth. And so this conflict is still ongoing. I think, you know, a lot of people feel like, wait, we still have U.S. troops in Syria? What happened there? You know, and that's the thing, is that this is so much out of the kind of consciousness of many Americans, but there is still an ongoing civil war going on. And, you know, I think it's really important to understand that people are still dying. This is a conflict that is not ending.
Another conflict that may have escaped most Americans' radar is in Sudan. Its capital, Khartoum, is expecting a visit from the U.S. envoy for the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, this weekend. But this week, tens of thousands of protesters took to the streets, and not for the first time. The country has been run by a transitional government since a coup in 2019. Joyce, this is Feltman's second trip to Sudan this month. Why is the U.S. monitoring the situation so closely here? And can you tell us more about these protesters and their frustrations?
Yes. I mean, we've seen on Thursday, some of the biggest protests this year to take place in Sudan across different cities that, for the most part, you know, stayed peaceful, and they are diverse in nature. The issue here is that we need to be paying attention to, as Sudan is going through political turmoil. We're seeing a divide between the military elite and the civilian leadership and the government. This divide is threatening to block the transition to a civilian rule. If you remember, Naila, in 2019, after the ouster of Omar al-Bashir, the dictator, the military is handling the transition, and the U.S. has been pushing and facing out this power to the civilian leadership. U.S. Envoy Jeffrey Feltman, as you mentioned, second trip in 3 weeks, just emphasizes the level of concern and attention that the U.S. is giving to Sudan. He told us ahead of his trip that it's very critical for Sudan to get the transition right, or some aspects of U.S. support in aid or facilitating debt relief could be cut. The concern in the U.S. is that if this transition fails in Sudan, if we see a military coup or a military takeover, that could take the country back to the 70s and the 80s, where we've seen waves of instability and back and forth, push and pull between the military and extremists or other groups in the country.
What has everyday life been like for the Sudanese since this coup?
I mean, so much has improved in Sudan. I mean, if you remember, Sudan was a country that hosted Osama bin Laden, that supported extremism. So that has changed a lot. The IMF granted Sudan in June $1.2 billion in debt relief. So things have been steadily improving. The problem here is the military has not been willing to concede power and facilitate the civilian democratic transition. The economy continues to suffer. Foods, you know, basic prices are going up, but without outside help and transition to civilian leadership, there is no other way out.
On Wednesday, Afghanistan's new Taliban rulers were in Moscow. They left the talks having won the backing from 10 regional powers for the idea of a United Nations donor conference to help the country stave off economic collapse and a humanitarian catastrophe. Joyce, this was the Taliban's most significant international meeting since seizing power over Afghanistan in mid-August. What happened?
Yes, actually, this is the first international conference for the Taliban, Naila. The U.S. did not attend, citing technical issues, but I think it's more political here. For Russia, they're treading very carefully in Afghanistan, given their history in the country, you know, the Soviet occupation in the 70s and the 80s, and the current fears of a spillover, if instability hit Afghanistan, a spillover into Russia. So what they've been trying to do is promising to help with aid to the Taliban government, but not offer recognition. They've kept their embassy open in Kabul and are calling for an inclusive government by the Taliban. The problem here, Naila, is, as you well know, is the Taliban is not listening, whether it's on issues related to women's rights, whether including, you know, other Afghan political factions in the government. They have resisted these calls. So it's hard to see a full international, you know, pivot when it comes to embracing the Taliban at the moment. But Russia is choosing the path of least resistance and offering some aid to the Taliban, bringing them into the fold with some regional countries attending, but waiting on the issue of recognition and full normalization with the group.
Joyce, to your point, at the talks, the Taliban's deputy prime minister, Abdul Salam Hanafi, said the extremist group did not pose any security threat to any other country. He asked the international community to recognize its government, which no nation has done so far.
It is the right of the people of Afghanistan that the new government be officially recognized. And obviously, should the new government not be officially recognized or supported, those groups that undermine security will be strengthened. Women are our sisters and mothers. They are respectable to us, and we will create conditions for them in the places where they are needed within the framework of the Sharia law.
At these talks, a spokesperson from the Kremlin said the Taliban is still considered officially, quote, a terror organization by Moscow. Jen, to what extent is this more about mapping out who's going to have a sphere of influence in the future, pointedly not including the United States in that, who was, for technical reasons, as Joyce said, not there?
I think that's definitely part of it. You know, Russia in particular, as Joyce very, very accurately laid out, you know, has its own history. It is the, you know, the one of the closest neighbors. It's certainly much closer than the United States is, and so it has its very own interests. So do several of the other, you know, Central Asian states that were involved in this conference. China is also interested in, you know, making sure that the Taliban government takeover doesn't spill over into the region. They have their own economic and security interests there. But I think, you know, in particular, what a lot of countries right now are really just trying to figure out how to deal with is the fact that Afghanistan's economy is in absolute free fall. It's in shambles. The Taliban, you know, fighting two decades worth of an insurgency does not necessarily make you good at running a massive national economy. Those are not necessarily related skills. And so I think a lot of the international community right now is concerned with how do they maintain aid to Afghanistan to make sure that the people of Afghanistan are not harmed by the political and diplomatic approaches that these countries have to take to the Taliban. And it's a really hard line to walk because they don't want to recognize the Taliban. They do want to try to maintain some degree of leverage to push the Taliban to be more inclusive, you know, and to let women be in other places than just the ones where they are needed as the Taliban.
As, or according to Sharia law, as I said. So, Indira, how does this work? I mean, as to Jen's point of like towing this line, how does the international community try to get them to follow through on promises about human rights? What are the chances of that strategy working?
Well, first of all, I want to say about this conference. This conference in Moscow was not about Afghanistan. It was about Russia. It was all about Russia trying to say, we're filling the void. The United States left and had this, you know, dishonorable exit from Afghanistan, and we're here. And don't forget that when the Taliban took over in Kabul in mid-August, the Russia had its own forces right there at the border with Tajikistan for military exercises. There were Russian armored vehicles there. So it was a signal that Moscow feels like it's ready to fill the security void now that the Americans are gone, despite having had this ugly history of an invasion of Afghanistan in 1979 and a 10-year extremely unpopular occupation, not to mention the propping up of a pro-Soviet government afterwards. So I just want to make clear, I don't think this is really about Russia wanting to help the Taliban. It's about Russia wanting to stick it to the U.S. and say, we are the power and the deciding force in Central Asia. So that's one thing. The second point about what to do about the Taliban. Look, the Taliban is out there trying to make themselves respectable because they need aid. As soon as they were not recognized and, you know, the Afghanistan is now hit with all these international economic restrictions and cuts in development aid, which was billions of dollars from the international community that kept the previous government afloat and allowed basic services to Afghan people. It's a very poor country. So I think this is just strategic. The Taliban are going to say whatever they want that they think is going to get them that aid money back. But I don't think we should be under any illusion that they actually are including women or being kind to minorities. I mean, the last 20 years plus the years they were in power 5 years before that show everything you need to know. A quarter century of the Taliban disrespecting women, not giving them rights, disrespecting and persecuting minority groups and Shia Muslims. So I just don't think anybody should be under the misapprehension that the Taliban 2.0 is anything different than the Taliban 1.0.
And Dara, to your point about Russia, there was also some news this week that will irk the Kremlin from Europe.
It's a particular honor for me to announce the decision of the Conference of Presidents to award the Sakharov Prize in 2021 to Alexei Navalny, Russian anti-corruption activist and an advocate for change.
That was the European Parliament's Vice President Heidi Hautala speaking on Wednesday, announcing the recipient of this year's Sakharov Prize for Freedom of Thought. It's the EU's top human rights award. And Vladimir Putin's sharpest critic and the country's most prominent political prisoner tweeted via his team that the award was both an honor and a great responsibility. Jen, can you remind us where Navalny is exactly, what we know about his health and why he's still in prison?
Yeah, he's still in prison. You know, he is not able, as you said, that tweet was put out by his team because he is not able to communicate with the outside world except for through his lawyers and his team. He is still in prison. If you remember, there was this, you know, big health issue previously where he eventually went on hunger strike to protest against the lack of medical care that he was getting from the prison authorities. That kind of quickly, the Kremlin kind of essentially stepped in and tried to make that, you know, big kind of protest go away and got him some medical care. So, you know, he still languishes in prison. That is one of the issues that they actually brought up when announcing this prize, is calling for his release. And I think it's just really important to understand, too, you know, the Kremlin has a really difficult time with this because they have to walk a fine line between giving him more attention. You know, Vladimir Putin famously refuses to say his name pretty much all the time. And so, you know, they don't want to give him more attention. And yet, when something like this happens and he gets a big international human rights prize, they kind of are pushed into a corner where they have to address the fact that, yes, they are holding a political prisoner. And so, you know, their response was very angry. They were asked about, you know, his, quote, immense bravery, you know, for which he was awarded the prize. And they said that the European Parliament probably considerably reduces the value of these words with this decision. That's according to the Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov. So the Kremlin has to walk this fine line, and it's definitely a poke in the eye to Vladimir Putin that Navalny was given this prize.
I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is 1A. To that point, Jen, about what the European Parliament's demands were made, let's actually hear European Vice President Heidi Hautala making that demand when she announced the prize.
On behalf of the European Parliament, I call for his immediate and unconditional release. All harassment, intimidation, and attacks against the opposition, civil society, and media by the Russian authorities must stop.
Joyce, with this sort of ratcheting up by the EU, to Jen's point, poking Putin in the eye here, why is Putin running the risk of making Navalny a martyr, elevating this conversation by keeping him in prison on behalf of, like, the EU and other people talking about his release?
I mean, I think for Vladimir Putin, the main calculus for him for years and decades has been power. So I also don't think he takes the EU threats or awards that seriously. Yes, it is a recognition of Navalny, who is emerging as the main opposition figure from Russia, even though he is in jail. But on the other hand, if you look at Vladimir Putin's relations with the EU, I mean, Nord Stream, the oil pipeline, is almost ready to launch. The economic cooperation between the two are ongoing. He has, sent enforcement to the Ukraine border, and we haven't seen much of a reaction from Europe. So yes, this award is symbolic. It's important, but when push comes to shove, and how the Europeans deal with Putin, there hasn't been many actions to push against Russia's growing economic and political influence in the continent.
Yeah, and let's just end on some global developments about the pandemic. Russia is actually enduring its worst wave yet. Moscow announced another lockdown on Thursday, a move the Kremlin previously had said it would avoid at all costs. According to the New York Times, nearly half of the world's population has received at least one dose of a coronavirus vaccine. And as of now, more than three quarters have been administered in high or upper middle income countries. And this week, a congressional inquiry in Brazil said President Bolsonaro should be charged with crimes against humanity and jailed for his, quote, macabre reaction to the COVID outbreak. More than 600,000 Brazilians have died. Indira, let's end on this. Does Bolsonaro have much to worry about here?
Look, this is a six-month Senate inquiry in Brazil that exposed so many scandals and corruption in the government. Of the 11 senators on the inquiry, seven of them are critics of Bolsonaro, so it's not incredibly surprising that they would come out accusing him of crimes against humanity. But let's put this in context. He is one of the leaders who, along with Donald Trump and Boris Johnson, downplayed COVID as a problem, compared it to the flu. This is a disease that has killed more than 600,000 Brazilians. In terms of absolute numbers, it's the second worst death toll after the United States. In terms of per capita based on population, it's worse than the United States. And in particular, Bolsonaro was very, not only blasé, but completely uncaring about the effect of COVID on indigenous groups, tribes, and communities that were otherwise cut off from Brazil and were wiped out by this disease. He's spoken out against lockdowns, masks, and vaccinations. You'll remember that back in September, when he came to the UN General Assembly in New York, he flouted the rules about your delegation needed to be vaccinated, and four of his people in his delegation got COVID. So I think it certainly shines a spotlight on his mishandling of the disease, and it will probably make it harder for him to be reelected in the next election. As for whether he actually gets charged with anything, you know, that's going to depend a lot on the balance of power in the Brazilian Senate, in, you know, in the judiciary, a lot of which is controlled by his supporters. So I don't know how far this actually goes, but it certainly makes a statement, and it should make other leaders worry. I've seen commentators writing already about, if Bolsonaro can be charged like this, can Donald Trump or Boris Johnson or others be charged? I don't see that happening, but I think it's very important that attention was paid to this because of the real human cost. And when you downplay the importance of masking and vaccines, it's the people who pay the price.
My thanks to Indira Lakshmanan, Senior Executive Editor at National Geographic, Jennifer Williams, Deputy Editor at Foreign Policy, and Joyce Cottom, Senior Correspondent for The National. 1A's Managing Producer is Paige Osborne. Jonquilin Hill is our Senior Producer. Mike Kidd is our Sound Designer and Engineer. And Barb Anguiano produces our podcast. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Nyla Boodoo from Axios Today, in for Jen White. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.